This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Records like For the Love of Money, Me and Mrs. Jones, I'll Be Around, If You Don't Know Me By Now, Love Train, Break Up to Make Up, and TSOP, a.k.a. the Soul Train theme, helped define what became known in the 70s as the Philly sound. My guests are two of the main architects of that sound, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. In 1971, they co-founded Philadelphia International Records and went on to write and produce many of the label's hits. The label was home to such groups as Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, the OJs, the Spinners, Billy Paul and McFadden and Whitehead. The new box set Love Train collects many of the hits from Philadelphia International Records, along with some Gamble and Huff collaborations that precede the label. Before we meet Gamble and Huff, let's hear one of the hits they wrote and produced from 1972. This is the OJs with Backstabbers. Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Leon Huff, was that you on the piano at the very beginning?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about figuring out what you were going to play there.
Backstabbers sounds like something like eerie, you know, something eerie. Like, so that roll was like something horrible, because that's what backstabbers are. So that roll reflected that type of a drama. And it worked.
Okay, so after we hear that opening, then the rhythm section comes in, and then the strings, and it's a really big production, which is something that Philadelphia International really specialized in. Kenny Gamble, you want to talk about that kind of big produced orchestral sound that you got?
Well, you know, that sound of the orchestra was always that was our dream to be able to play. So many counter melodies that came along with those songs that the orchestra was able to put that together. And plus, too, you know, during the time when we were coming along, it was stereo. Radio had just come into really, like, it's putting it in cars. I mean, it was everywhere. Stereo went from mono to stereo, and so you had a lot of space, you know, to fill up. You know, stereo was much more soothing than mono, so we had we thought about the mixes that we could do, and the music was not only funky, it was classical at the same time. So the string players and horn players, you know, we had the greatest orchestra, I think MFSB, that was the name of the orchestra.
How did you know a lot about the instruments of the orchestra that you wouldn't typically hear in a small band, like French horns,
yeah,
or
right,
flugelhorns.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Did you study that kind of, like, how did you develop an ear for those kinds of instruments?
Well, I've come in contact with those types of instruments because I was in a band in elementary school, marching band.
Oh, I love marching. I was in a band like that, too.
Great experience,
yeah.
You know. So I had the opportunity to hear trombones and French horns and flutes and piccolos and all that kind of good stuff that makes up a fantastic orchestra. So that's how I became familiar, you know, vibes, bells, maracas, shakers, tambourines, the whole nine yards, and Gamble experienced the same thing, too. That's why we was able to incorporate those type of sounds.
Kenny Gamble, were you in a marching band also?
No, marching band. But we had a band, and I think that the music that influenced me most, you know, from like the early, late 50s, like Burt Bacharach, Hal David, and Lieber and Stroller, you know what I mean? The Drifters, when they had strings and they first introduced the strings. And
yeah, strings and timpani and
everything. Yeah. You know, There Goes My Baby. I think that was probably one of the first songs that had full orchestra. And then Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach and Hal David. I mean, they did some fantastic arrangements, and they used all kinds of instruments doing that, and the rhythmic things. So we were a products of that era, and also the Motown era, which had the greatest influence, which also used a lot of horns and baritone saxes and things like that. So we stretched out, and plus Tommy Bell, Bobby Martin, the arrangers, they would also make suggestions from time to time. Well, why don't you use an oboe over here, or this, or whatever? And it all worked, you know, worked together once we were able to get in that studio.
Let's hear another great track from Philadelphia International Records that's on the new box set. And we're going to hear If You Don't Know Me By Now by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. And Teddy Pendergrass sings lead on this. And I think, Leon Huff, you're the one who discovered that Teddy Pendergrass could sing as good as he did.
Well, you know, caught my ear, you know, in a rehearsal. His particular sound.
He was the drummer with the band. Did you know that
baritone.
He could sing?
No, not really. You know, his voice just stood out, you know, amongst the other voices, and it just grabbed your ear. Mine, anyway, at first.
Plus, Hal Melvin knew that he could sing, you know. Hal was really the architect of that group, of the Blue Notes. He'd been in the Blue Notes since in the late 50s. And so that's why eventually what we decided to do is call it Hal Melvin and the Blue Notes, because the Blue Notes kept changing, but Hal Melvin remained there all the time. And then Teddy Pendergrass came along.
His voice roared.
Yeah, so we called it Hal Melvin and the Blue Notes featuring Teddy Pendergrass.
Did Harold Melvin mind that Teddy Pendergrass was singing lead and not Harold Melvin?
Yeah, he minded. because it was Hal Melvin and the Blue Notes, and people thought that Teddy Pendergrass was Harold Melvin.
Right.
And so he used to come to me and say, man, they think that Teddy's Harold Melvin. I said, well, you know, don't worry about it.
That was that power shining through.
Well, before we hear If You Don't Know Me By Now, do you want to say anything else to introduce it about how you wrote the song, for instance?
All I knew, we was in the room in Gamble's office. That's where the piano was, an old upright. When we was just, the ideas were just coming. I don't know how that song came about.
Well, you just go and suppose you got a friend or you're in a relationship. So I said, they said, well, where you been at? You know, I was working. I was doing what they, you know, and then you, all of a sudden you say, well, if you don't know me by now, you'll never know me. I mean, that's like a relationship kind of thing where people have gone through that. Everybody's gone through that. Millions of people going through that every day.
But we haven't written songs about it, so what made you realize that was a good hook for a song?
Well, ideas pop into your head.
Just feeling good.
And so Huff and I, we used to write titles down. You know, we come in with a legal pad full of nothing but titles. And that's how we would get our songs, because each title had a story to it. So we're playing around and messing around and
Pick one.
And then all of a sudden, you know, if you don't know me by now, you never know me. Seemed like it fit the order of the day.
Okay, so this is Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes from 1972 with Teddy Pendergrass singing lead. And my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, wrote the song and produced the record.
Right.
And won a Grammy.
And won a Grammy for it. Okay.
That we've been through, you should understand me like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home. We only act like children when we argue for the fight.
That's Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes with Teddy Pendergrass singing lead, recorded in 1972, written and produced by my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. And while we were listening to that, Kenny Gamble, you were telling me something I want you to repeat.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that doing the background, see, Huff and myself and Bonnie Sigler, we used to do a lot of backgrounds on records. Because, not saying that the group wasn't really good, but the certain sound that we wanted. And so on that, if you don't know me by now, is Gamble, Huff, and Bunny Sigler. We're doing the background.
Yeah, boy, they can harmonize, boy.
Yeah, me and Huff and Bunny Sigler, I mean, we really had a good sound together. And in fact, like on a lot of stylistic songs, you know, we sang on the stylistic songs in the background. And Joe Simon, we sang on Joe Simon.
Archie Bell.
We were the drills. I mean, you know.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. So if you don't know me by now, we were singing that. I don't know if I can hit them notes again, but.
Well, that leads me right to where I want to go. I mean, I know you used to sing in a group called the Romeos.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of fun with the Romeos. And Huff and Roland Chambers, Carl Chambers.
Yeah, it was great.
Winnie Wolford and Tom Bell and myself, you know, we were an excellent band, mm-hmm. and we sang together. We had sort of like the best part of the band when, you know, was when we used to sing songs like the Four Freshmen. You know what I mean? We'd have that kind of modern harmony kind mm-hmm. of songs, and we did the standard Moon River. We had a great arrangement of Moon River, and we had a great arrangement of I Wish You Love.
Oh yeah,
huh.
Huff would play the drums on there, mm-hmm. and Roland and Carl, his brother, and we would sing together. So we could sing a little bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Neither of you is going to do a few bars of Moon River for me.
Okay, no.
You know, I can't even hardly remember it. I know it had a bass line, boom, doom, 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 something like that.
It was great, you know. It was funny. That was the highlight of my early music career as a musician from Camden, New Jersey. At that time, I felt like I could play good enough to join a band, and I kept hearing about Kenny Gamble and the Romeos appearing down at this club in Longside, New Jersey called Loretta's Hi-Hat. And I had a day gig at Cooper Hospital. But every weekend, see, word of mouth is powerful.
You better believe it.
And that's all I heard. It was Kenny Gamble. It was Kenny Gamble and the Romeos. They're down there. So I had an opportunity to be off one weekend, and I caught a ride down there, and they had lines around the corner, people trying to get into this club. They had busloads. I mean, you might have thought the Rolling Stones or somebody, you know? So it took me about an hour to get in. But once I got in, then I could see why, because they was rocking the place. Yeah. So me as a musician, I could be in a band like that, because I thought I could play that good, you know, at that time, you know.
Well, you know, I should mention early, Leon Huff, early in your career, you also did some session work for Phil Spector.
Yeah.
Play piano on the mm-hmm. famous Phil Spector yeah. Christmas album.
That's right.
You did work with Lieber and Stoller.
Yeah.
Did you think that was your future, doing session work?
That
or did you think you'd become a songwriter, producer?
I wanted to be, you know, as a young boy, I always had albums in my house. My mother used to take us to music stores, albums, to read liner notes. I used to do all of that, you know.
To read liner notes?
Then they had liner notes in back of albums.
Uh-huh, yeah,
I used to read all of them, you know. And I always wanted to be a studio musician. That's what I wanted to do.
What did you learn from working with Phil Spector and Lieber and Stoller, great producers, that you applied to Philadelphia International Records?
Phil Spector had a whole different approach.
What did he do?
The wall of sound, you know. You know, you have every individual musician play their part down, you know. Then he worked for hours on the drum sound. He'll tell all the musicians to take a break. And he'll be in there like 2 or 3 hours just working with them drums. So if you listen to his productions, then you'll see that it sounds like nothing else.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, the creators of Philadelphia International Records, who they had a zillion hits. They're producers, songwriters, and performers. And there's a new 4-CD box set that collects just some of their work together. And the box set actually starts before you founded Philadelphia International Records with some of the hits that you had for other record labels. Mm-hmm. And I want to play one of those. And I think this is the first real hit that you had. It's from 1967, and it's Expressway to Your Heart, The Soul Survivors. Tell us how this recording came to be. Why don't you start with writing the song? And let me say, you're from Philadelphia, Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff. You're from Camden. Close enough.
Yeah, and that's East Philly, Camden.
Yeah, it's just right over the river in New Jersey. And there is an expressway in Philadelphia called the Schuylkill Expressway that is famous for its unpredictable traffic jams.
Right.
So does the Schuylkill Expressway, is that the expressway referred to in Expressway to Your Heart? Were
that's
you thinking
it.
About that?
Yeah,
that's
Gamble wrote the lyrics. Yeah. I think it's one of the most clever lyrics I've ever heard. You know?
What happened with that song? It's sort of like it's self-explanatory. I was on my way over to see a friend of mine, a young lady. So the expressway was just backed up. That's when they first started the expressway. This is 67, so it was just beginning. I'm sitting there for, it seemed like hours, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I started beating on the dashboard, you know, talking about expressway to your heart, trying to get to you, you know what I mean? And as I come through, then I see Huff, I said, Huff, expressway to your heart, dude. Put that bass line, doom, doom, doo, doo, doo. And that was, you know, that's how songs come, though. Songs come from your imagination. You just got to be quick. You got to be quick to capture the moment for the concepts. And
so when you were in the car writing that song on the way to see your woman friend, who did you end up seeing first, Leon Huff or her?
Oh, I saw her first.
Yeah, yeah.
You saw her first.
Yeah, I saw her first. Yeah.
So you kept it in
your mind. I saw Huff the next day, But I write stuff down, though, because I forget it.
Now, Leon Huff, did you think what this song needs to start with? Well, first of all, it starts with horns, like, you know, car horns honking in traffic. And the horns are tuned. I mean, there's
they
a
sound
line,
like it, don't they?
Yeah, there's a line with, like, one horn, and then that line is repeated in different pitch. In another horn, and they're in harmony with each other. So,
it sounds like it.
Are those real car horns, or did you?
Oh yeah, they're real car horns. But you know where that was inspired a little bit by? There was a song called "Summer in the City."
Oh yeah.
Summer in the City. They had car horns.
That's
in it
true.
And stuff
they
like
did.
That.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
Joe
yeah.
Targe and I, we just
he was the engineer. Joe
he
Targe.
Was the engineer, yeah. And so we got some. They have these sound effect records. Where you can, they have car horns on it. They got everything on them, sound effect records. And so we just used the car horns on it. And just one more thing about that song that a lot of people don't know is that we use the same lyrics in the expressway that we used in a song with the Temptations and the Supremes, I'm Gonna Make You Love Me.
Wait, I know that song, but I'm trying to think of what the similarity is.
Okay, the Temptations, I'm Gonna Make You Love Me, yes, well. Every minute, every hour, I'm going to shower you with love and affection. Look, it's coming your direction. Okay, you see it now, right?
Yes,
expressway,
in your direction. So,
right,
yeah.
The same thing. Sounds coming in your direction on the expressway. Oh. Same thing, see?
Is that cheating?
No. That's being beautiful. That's really taking advantage of creativity, you know?
You can say a lot of things in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, this is a great record. I've always loved this record.
Yeah.
It's Expressway to Your Heart, The Soul Survivors, 1967, written by my guests, Gamble and Huff, and produced by you too, right?
Yeah, we produced it.
And Leon Huff, are you playing on this?
Yes.
Is you at the piano?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the songwriting and production team Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They co-founded Philadelphia International Records in 1971, which defined the Philly sound. They modeled their label on Motown Records. They have a new Philly sound box set called Love Train, named after one of Gamble and Huff's many hits. When we left off, they were talking about writing and producing the hit Expressway to Your Heart, which they recorded with the Soul Survivors before Gamble and Huff founded their own label. What impact did that recording have on your careers?
Expressway, boy, it had a tremendous impact. And I think one of the good things about it was that the Soul Survivors was a great performing act. Mm-hmm. They were performing places and just turning the places out, but it was like a breakthrough for us, for Gamble and Huff, because it seems like everything started to happen from then, because right after, during the same time as the Expressway, we recorded The Intruders with Cowboys the Girls.
Love that song.
So we had been trying with The Intruders, with United, together. We had had four or five different records before them. They were building, but then Cowboys the Girls came out and just exploded. So we was on a roll. That's when we went up to Motown. You know, went up to Motown. We had Expressway on the charts and Cowboys the Girls.
Yeah.
Had two records like in the top 10. So we figured we'd go to Motown, you know.
And why didn't you stay there? Like, what didn't work when you were thinking of
I think it was kind of far away, number one. You know, our families were here in Philadelphia. And I think we were just basically going exploratory, you know, let's see what's up there, because we had admired them so much, you know.
Yeah.
And we met Holland Dozier and Holland. We met Norman Whitfield. We met all these great songwriters and producers that we admired for so many years. And we wanted to see whether or not there was an opportunity at Motown.
That's all it was.
But what happened was is that from a business standpoint and from a logistics standpoint, I think that me and Huff decided when we were there, we said, hey, I think we better try to do this back in Philly.
Mm.
You know, and you know, thank God it worked out real, real good for us. The timing was good. And Motown will always be my favorite record company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know how you said you kept a list of titles and then eventually wrote songs that would grow out of the titles? Was Cowboys to Girls one of the titles that was on your list before it was a song?
Oh, yeah.
It was on the
no
list.
No question about it.
And do you remember how it got on the list in the first place?
Cowboys and Girls, because it's a story. That story is like a story about a guy who grows up, like little kids. They grow up and the guy be beating the girls up and they be pulling their hair. And, you know, they don't treat them tender. And then all of a sudden he grows up and say, hey, you know, now I know girls are made for kissing. Mm-hmm. You know, ain't a fun reminiscing. And the girl, she went from baby dolls to boys. You know, it's just clever. I tried to, the lyrics that we were trying to put together was something that was a little bit different and a little, like Expressway to Your Heart was different, right? Cowboys to Girls was different, you know, and it's so many other ones, I can't think of them right now, but try to take a different angle to songs. Like Smokey Robinson used to write songs like The Tears of a Clown and, you know, try to be as clever as possible.
That's the word, clever.
So let's squeeze in Cowboys to Girls. It's one of the songs featured on the new 4-CD box set of songs mostly from Philadelphia International Records, but also some of the songs that were Gamble and Huff collaborations before they created Philadelphia International. And this is one of those songs that they did before Philadelphia International Records. Right. This is Cowboys to Girls.
Boys and girls, I remember when I used to play shoot 'em up, bang bang, baby. I remember when I chased the girls and beat 'em up. But I was young and didn't understand. Thank you.
Cowboys to Girls, written by my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, the founders of Philadelphia International Records, and there's a new 4-CD box set that collects music from Philadelphia International Records and some of the Gamble and Huff collaborations that preceded that record label. Now, you're from Philly. You've been working Philly and Camden. And Philadelphia International Records has been headquartered in Philadelphia, which was also the home, when you were getting started, of American Bandstand with Dick Clark. And that had a really strong impact on the Philadelphia music scene. And the record label Cameo Parkway, which was based in Philadelphia, had a lot of performers that ended up being stars on Bandstand, including Dee Dee Sharp, Chubby Checker and his record The Twist, Bobby Rydell.
Frankie Avalon. Fabian. Orleans. The Dovells. The Orleans. Mm. I mean, it was a tremendous music.
Impact did that have on you, having the Cameo Parkway label feeding American Bandstand? Like, what did you learn from watching that?
Hmm. Well, we learned so much from them is that our offices, we're in the same offices that Cameo Parkway. Where they used to be, 309 South Broad Street.
And you had the engineer that they used to have.
Same engineer. We bought that building like in 1970, 71. And I think Cameo Parkway was another learning tool for us because they basically had a group of writers too. They were, Motown was inspired them because when you go to Cameo Parkway, they had a library and they had every Motown record you could think of. And all the writers at Cameo Parkway was basically listening to Motown records trying to really duplicate the Motown sound. And I think Cameo Parkway and Bandstand to me was like American Idol is today. You could get an artist on Bandstand during that time and he perform his record, and in a day or two he had the number one record in the country because Bandstand had that much influence in the music industry.
I think the period when you start having hits is past when Bandstand was really still based in Philadelphia.
Oh, it was gone then.
Yeah.
Bandstand was gone.
So you couldn't really break your records on Bandstand.
No, in fact, Soul Train had come into play.
Well, that's right. Where I'm heading is Soul Train.
Yeah, Soul Train was. I mean, we started around 63, 64, somewhere around there, and you go all the way to. From that era to Bandstand leaving, going to California, and Soul Train sort of picked up where Bandstand left off at.
You wrote the record that became the theme for Soul Train, TSOP, The Sound of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my first question about that is, why did you do an instrumental? I mean, instrumentals were basically, they'd kind of fallen from fashion by the time that you did this. The things had vocals on them. So why did you even think about doing an instrumental?
Mm. Well, you know, it had words to it, too.
Yeah.
You know, the 3 Degrees was on there, Soul Train, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Soul Train. I mean, you know, he was singing Soul Train. Plus, too, we always looked at it like Johnny Carson. You know, he had a theme song. You know, da-da-da-da-da, that's Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. All right, you take Bob Hope. He's got Thanks for the Memories.
Yeah.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody great has kind of like, you know, from television, has a theme song. So we wanted to give Don Cornelius a theme song.
Did he ask you to write one?
Yeah, he came. He came into Philly. You know, because the music he had on there, he was a real good friend of ours. Still is a good friend of ours. You know, and all of our artists was on his show. You know, and so, in talking to him one day, we're talking about his theme song. I said, you need to get a better theme song. So he said, I'll come in. So he came in, and me and Huff and all the musicians, we got together. Mm. And like the first day, like Huff always said, we didn't get too much the first day.
Mm-mm.
So me and Huff went back to the office, and that melody came up. That's Soul Train. And then once you got that melody, then you put the other pieces to it. I put that da-da-da-da-da-da. You know what I mean? And then that did it, you know? So.
Okay, so this is TSOP, The Sound of Philadelphia, which you also know as the theme from Soul Train. And this was written and produced by my guests, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. play another record that you wrote together and that you produced. And this is Me and Mrs. Jones, which Billy Paul recorded. And I've read that you have described this as one of the trickiest songs that you did. And I'm wondering what was tricky about it?
That's probably was me telling that. Because it was just, I had a different feel. It was more jazz orientated. I remember when Gamma was showing me the chords, because he had the chord progressions. That's in the intro, and I couldn't catch it for a minute because it had a different type of a timing factor. It was different, you know. I never played a song like that until, you know, I got to learn it, you know. But that was the most different track of tracks, I think.
How did it start off? I mean, how did the idea start off?
The idea started off with... Well, me and Huff used to go to, it was a little bar downstairs from the Schubert building. That's when we were in the Schubert building. We used to go down there every day and talk to the barmaid. And this guy used to come into the bar every day. Little guy looked like a judge or something like that, right? So me and Huff, we're watching everything. See, we're songwriters. So we sit, everything we're doing, we're thinking about a song, yes. So we see this guy come in there. We said, okay. Then the next day he come in there again. But when he come in there every day, this girl would come in maybe 10, 15 minutes after he get there. They sit in the same booth, go to the jukebox, play the same songs every day. So me and Huff, we said, oh, that's me and Mrs. Jones or whatever the name we was going to call it. But that's how that song evolved itself. And then when they get ready to leave, he would go his way, she would go hers. So it could have been his daughter, it could have been his niece, it could have been anybody. But we created a story out of this, that there was some kind of romantic connection between these people. And we go upstairs in our office and we wrote the song, Me and Mrs. Jones.
Me and Mrs. Jones. Got a thing going on. We both know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We meet every day same cafe, 6:30, and no one knows she'll be there. Holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays our favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on.
It's Me and Mrs. Jones. It's one of the recordings on a new 4-CD box set that collects some of the recordings from Philadelphia International Records, the label that was founded by my guests Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They wrote a lot of the hits on their label, including the record that we just heard, and produced a lot of those records, too. And Leon Huff played keyboard on a lot of those records, too, including the one we just heard?
Yeah.
What do you consider to be, like, the end of the real, like, glory days of Philadelphia International Records?
I think it kind of like around about 80, 86, somewhere around there, 87. Patti LaBelle, we had a big hit with Patti LaBelle around. But it started to fall apart a little bit, like the early 80s.
Because?
Well, I think people started to evolve. They wanted to do other things. And once you get hot like that, then everybody's after you. You know what I mean? All the record companies was after the artists, you know, and the writers wanted to, you know, to start their own thing and so forth. And that's natural, you know, for people to want to do that, you know. So I think we had a good run. We at least had a good almost 20-year run, strong run, you know. And
Was music changing also, like hip hop?
Yeah, I think music so. Yeah, the music was changing also at the same time.
How did you feel about that when there's a kind of like you kind of help create a sound, and then that sound is kind of becoming a little dated as a new sound as hip hop comes in?
Well, I was glad, to be honest with you.
Why were you glad?
Well, I was kind of glad because we had worked so hard. I mean, even now I'm happy. You know, I mean, I'm thankful for what we had. I'm glad for what we had, but you know, it's like, I always had a perspective in my mind. I said, I know this thing's not going to last. Nothing lasts forever. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to talk about that all the time. So, you know, it ain't going to last forever. So let's get the juice out of it now, whatever we can get. You know, let's keep writing and whatever the case might be. Because, I mean, every song we were writing was becoming a smash. So, I mean, how long do you think that's going to last? I mean, mm-hmm. you're taking that kind of energy out of you. So, and so when it started to slow down, you know, I was thankful and... And I was kind of glad because that schedule was unbelievable, you know. And you start to feel it after a while, you know, doing 12, 13 albums a year. You know, we had a good staff of people working with us, but it was no question, it was a lot. Sure. To get one song, one good song, we had to maybe write 10 songs.
Would you produce all 10 and then decide which was best, or just
sometimes? Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would do that. Sometimes, like when the OJs or Teddy Pendergrass would come in, we would record maybe 30 songs on them, just to get 8.
Of the songs that you wrote together, do you have a favorite that we should end with?
Yeah, go ahead, Gam.
Well, Love Train.
Yeah,
Love Train. That to me is the song that the kind of capsulizes everything that we were thinking about, the message that we wanted to get out. You know, we're always talking about a message in the music, and Love Train is like international, very optimistic about life and the world, you know, people living together in harmony and unity, you know. So I think Love Train is something everybody better get on board, because if you miss it, I feel sorry for you.
Those core beer commercials really made it popular.
Yeah, of course,
Thank you both so much. Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us.
Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff co-founded Philadelphia International Records and wrote and produced many of the label's hits. Their new box set is called Love Train. A TV companion called Love Train will be shown on many PBS stations in December. It's been 30 years since gay activist Harvey Milk was elected to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors. He served less than a year. In 1978, he was murdered, along with San Francisco Mayor George Moscone, by former supervisor Dan White. Milk's life was the subject of an acclaimed documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk. Now Gus Van Sant has directed a feature film called Milk, starring Sean Penn. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It's tempting to describe the biopic Milk as a hagiography, a life of a saint and martyr. But that wouldn't be entirely apt, since the movie is buoyant and exhilarating, and since it pointedly reverses the usual trajectory. Instead of forswearing the flesh for a life of the spirit, Sean Penn's Harvey Milk reaches the spirit by surrendering to the flesh, big time. His salvation begins in 1970, on the eve of his 40th birthday, when he picks up a young Midwestern stud in a New York City subway station. After Happy Sex, Milk lies beside Scott Smith, played by James Franco, and muses on the life he has lived, his sexual orientation under wraps. Emboldened, he sets off with his new lover for San Francisco's Castro District, for a life to be lived above ground, in the light. With arrivals pouring in, the Castro is a burgeoning gay ecosystem, and director Gus Van Sant and cinematographer Harris Savides have an easy, open touch, as if they're shooting a documentary. Unlike Brokeback Mountain, the gay couplings aren't hallowed. Every smooch doesn't carry the weight of the world. The characters are just doing what comes naturally, even when it's done by hetero actors like Penn. Penn's transformation is startling. I've never seen smile lines on his face, yet here they are, crevices, going deep. His voice is light, minus low tones. He's unprecedentedly giddy. There's anger, but it never festers. It's channeled into political action. In the tedious remake of All the King's Men, Penn put method acting pauses in the scenes of Willie Stark finding his soapbox voice. He seemed too inward to play a rabble-rouser. Here, he shakes off method self-attention. For Milk, the personal became political, and Penn opens the windows to his character's soul and gets visibly high on the breeze. Milk becomes an activist almost immediately. He organizes a boycott of businesses in the neighborhood that are hostile to gays. When that's successful, he sets out to become the first openly gay elected office holder in San Francisco. There's a small amount of drama within the gay community. Milk butts heads with the cautious owner of the magazine, The Advocate. But when he wins office on the third try, the threats come from outside, from Anita Bryant's anti-gay ballot initiatives, and later, Milk's murderer, fireman-turned-supervisor Dan White, played by Josh Brolin in a bowl haircut. In an attempt to be friendly, White shows up at Milk's office as Milk confers with aides, among them Emil Hirsch as bespectacled activist Cleve Jones.
Okay, first order of business to come out of this office is the citywide gay rights ordinance, just like the one that Anita shot down in Dade County. What do you think, Lovis Blossom?
I think it's good. It's not great.
Okay, so make it brilliant. We want Anita's attention here in San Francisco. I wanted to bring her fight to us. We need a unanimous vote. We need headlines.
Dan White is not going to vote for this.
Dan White will be fine. Dan White is just uneducated. You'll teach him.
Hey, Harv, committee meets at 9:30. Hey, you guys. Say, did you get the invitation to my son's christening? I invited a few of the other soups, too.
Oh, well, I'll be there.
Great. Thanks.
Are you going?
I would let him christen me if it means he's going to vote for the gay rights ordinance. We need allies.
I think he can hear
me. We need everyone.
Jesus.
I don't think he heard you.
Is it just me, or is he cute?
Brolin's Dan White is riveting, the only character in the movie with a meaty subtext, although it's not always clear what that subtext is. The approach of Van Sant and screenwriter Dustin Lance Black isn't overly psychological. We know White's a homophobe. Milk thinks he's a closet case. We see he's desperate to keep his job and feels let down by Milk on the legislative front. In any case, Milk doesn't see the bullets coming. He's too elated by the theater of politics, by exercising power for the first time. Lovers drift in and out, but we're not entirely sure how Milk could possibly take in a Mexican lover played by Diego Luna, who is so obviously nuts. The film doesn't probe too deeply, possibly because people from Milk's orbit are still around and were around the set. More likely because the filmmakers mean to inspire future generations of gay activists. It turns out to be a timely message with the passage of Proposition 8 in Milk's old stomping grounds. Good as Sean Penn is, it's too bad he didn't have a chance to show Milk before his gay emergence. Not because we need to see the same old coming out of the closet story, but because the before picture, Milk Among the Straights, would give the after picture more weight. But these are quibbles. Milk is one of the most heartfelt portraits of a politician ever made. The personal and the political aren't just hand in hand. They dance.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.